Thank you. Pleasure to be here and to hear what's on. This will be a slight change away from microarray data. The area of phylogeny is a little more, has been around for a longer period of time. The statistical issues are still quite the number of issues still outstanding, a number of things which are hard to do, and there's a lot of work that, a lot of things we need to figure out. I'm going to talk about robustness in this context, and as you'll see, to do the build a, to estimate a tree of evolution, one needs a model. We will have there are a number of models and variations on them. One's always interested in the extent to which deviations from the model can really mess you up. I mean, that's a robustness issue. The molecular biologists do not believe the models. They're an approximation, as most are. And the key question is, what parts of this approximation are critical? What parts can we not worry about too much? So as this is saying, we have sequence data, and for our purposes, it can either be nucleotide, a four-letter alphabet, or amino acid, a 20-letter alphabet. And we have it for a set of distinct taxa. Now, we have, in a sense, we have data at the terminal node of the tree. Those are the taxa that are currently existing, and we're trying to understand how they've evolved from each other. If you take the higher primates, you've got chimps and gorillas, humans, various types of monkeys, you want to know, at some point, we had a common ancestor. We want to know how they evolved. That's what's going on. So we have intermediate nodes in our tree. As soon as we have a tree, we'll have intermediate nodes. We have, of course, missing data at all those nodes, so there's a large missing data. In many settings, we have sequence data. In the past, it's typically been from a single gene, and which you have to find the same gene in all attacks of interest so you can line up the sequences. People are starting to take data, concatenate genes, take data across a series of genes. Sequence length, typically 300 would be a fairly short sequence. So your data array, you'll have a number of taxa and then a sequence length anywhere from 3 to 5,000. I'm sure there are longer ones. Those are typical lengths. If you want to think asymptotic, you have to sort of say, what are our asymptotics going to be in? It's going to usually be in the length of the sequence, you know, as you let the length of the sequence get large. Question the extent to which, you know, the asymptotics will play a role. I mean, we use asymptotics to give us guides as to what we expect to go on. Let me just say this work is joint with been helped by a number of people at Dalhousie. I better give credit to to Genome Atlantic, which is funding a lot of this work. They're a group of molecular biologists and statisticians working together with sort of postdocs and graduate students. So they've been very helpful. This is sort of just a cartoon analysis of what you're doing. This is courtesy of one of Andrew Roger, one of the molecular biologists. You have a favorite gene. Just to show you what goes on in phylogenetics, you retrieve the homologs, you align them. Now, I'm not going to talk about the alignment problem. There's clearly issues about getting the alignment right and making mistakes in alignments. They use hidden Markov models, I think, are some of the standard alignment techniques. So I'm not going to look at that too much. And then you infer a phylogenetic tree. And most of the techniques are maximum likelihood techniques, very familiar territory for statisticians. There are some things which make this problem a little bit tougher than standard maximum likelihood, and I'll just make reference to those. Just to show you, I mean, this is just to, these colors don't mean anything that Rob had up on his. This is just data I got from one of the people, the short, small subunit R, ribosomal RNA. It's something we all need, so you can find it in every living organism, and so it's viewed as the gold standard for, if you want to talk about a tree of life, it would probably be built on this this sort of data. This is in ribosomal, it's an RNA, so we've got U's instead of the T's, but you've got your four-letter alphabet, and you'll see there are gaps in the data, and all data is going to have a certain number of gaps, which correspond to either deletions or insertions of DNA, as you. These are species coming down the rows. If you're a true molecular biologist, you can give the full Latin name for any one of them. I suspect these are all fairly small eukaryotes. The group I'm working with is interested in early eukaryote evolution. So these would be the species, and this is, I know there are probably 20 or 30 species there. That's a typical size of the number of taxa that you might use. So let me just talk briefly about the model that we're going to use. At least the model that seems to be in most common usage. We need something to model evolution. We start with a common ancestor, and at a particular site, things have changed over time, if they're correctly aligned. Not all organisms have the same letter at each site. So we need a mark, and the standard model, or the most common one now, is a continuous time reversible Markov model. And given a fixed tree and branch length, the length of the branches, one can compute a likelihood, and I'll just show you a simple calculation of this. A key assumption that is made is that the evolution at each site is assumed to be independent, and that, of course, means that if we've got 500 sites or 1,000 sites, I simply have to work out the likelihood site by site and multiply them together to get the overall likelihood. Certainly it's recognized that the rate of evolution can vary across sites, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, and that's typically modeled as a random effect in the model. So we've got missing data, we've got random effects, and that starts to tell us that there's at least some challenging statistics as soon as you throw those things in. We talk about the maximum likelihood tree. Except for a small number of taxa, we simply can't compute it. With 15 taxa, there are this number of trees, and if you think in terms of optimization, we don't have derivatives, so you have to find clever ways of searching tree space, and there's probably been 15 or 20 years of some very computationally smart computer scientists, biologists who have worked on this, and there are a number of very good, there are a number of algorithms to help you move through tree space. You have to search cleverly, and some of them are based on putting together four or five and then cleverly adding, much in the way we build models. We add variables one at a time. So you put together some taxa and build it, and then you try to get trees that way, and then you reshuffle and start over again with a different set, and you try to work out. One of the problems is, and this is a limitation, is that if you've got 20 or 30 trees, the time to find the maximum likelihood tree, even with a good algorithm, is measured much closer to days rather than hours, and you just have to do a lot of searching to get it. So those are that. I mean, we're obviously going to have to resort to things like Bootstrap at some point. I won't talk about that today, but that makes you have to be very thoughtful about the type of Bootstrap you do if you're going to, you know, if you're going to take a number of hours to do it. Let me just show you very, very simple example of what we might do to work out the likelihood. If you have data at a site, you have these. We have A, C, and T at the nodes. We've got two interior nodes, which I've just labeled Y1 and Y2. And what I have to do is I have to sum over all possible values of Y1 and Y2. This is for nucleotides, that'll be 4 values. For amino acids, 20. And these pi's are the frequencies of Y1 in here, because that's starting. This is the probability of going from Y1, Y2 in time T1. Probability of going from Y2 to A in time T2, Y2 to C in T3, Y1 to T in T4. So in some sense, it's not a complicated issue. You do have to, you have to be careful about how you do this. You're doing an awful lot of summing, and Joe Felsenstein in the early 80s developed the pulley principle, which was just using the reversibility in a clever way, which has made these trees computable. You can work out the likelihood. Py 1 y 2 of t is determined by a matrix, a trans e to the tq, where q is the instantaneous rate matrix, and it's always scaled so the expected number of changes in time t is t. We have some indeterminacy otherwise. So there's always a scaling going on. That's the model. We have parameters in Q. We have our pies. We have the branch lengths and the tree structure, what we have to estimate. Now, let's just, since I'm talking about robustness, I got into this area about 3 years ago, and there are annual meetings, CIAR meetings on phylogenetics, I guess. I'm never quite sure of the name. And I attended my first one about 3 years ago. And this particular result was presented there. It was from two people. And Jan Andersen was a postdoc at Andrew Rogers, a molecular biologist. They were interested in testing for alternate phylogenies in cyanobacterial genes in eukaryotes. And if you look at the literature, there are two standard procedures that you would use to do the tests. And people use these tests because they sit on Joe Felsenstein's website, and you can download them quickly, the Shimadara Hasegawa test, Swofford, Olson, Willison, Hillis test. One of them is essentially a non-parametric bootstrap. One's a parametric bootstrap. So these are the standard procedures and that are in the literature. They're sensibly designed. Let me just show you the thing they wanted to test. This is on the 6-phosphogluconate something. I haven't mastered the pronunciation of all these easily. We have a group of taxa here. The red are eukaryotes, the black are eubacteria, then we have some proteobacteria. These are all tend to be primitive organisms. One of the organisms that is of particular interest is this little one, Giardia lamblia. Now, Giardia is what gives you beaver fever. It's not a particularly nice little organism. It's in fact, it caused a lot of intestinal upset, apparently, and all through North America and in many, many places. You'll notice that it is not branching with the other with the other eukaryotes, either the animal fungi down here or the plant protists up at the top. So the question is this clade, is this real or is it just, you know, is it real or is it just measuring? Now, the numbers that are on here are so-called bootstrap supports, which are done by techniques which Joe Felsenstein developed, modified a little bit by Brad Efron and Susan Holmes. And but the question is, does this Giardia, you know, what we're going to do is test the hypothesis, and I'll just show you the test. Does it fit in with the plant protists? And this is a transferrin. This isn't mine. This was given at the talk 3 years ago. We have a hypothesis here, Giardia lambda in with the plant protists. So what you do is, with any test, you now fit the tree under this constraint. The Giardia has to branch with the plant protist clade, and as we would with statistics, we get a change in the log likelihood. I mean, this is just your maximum likelihood unconstrained versus the maximum likelihood under the null hypothesis. If life was fair, it would be twice that. We'd have a nice chi-squared distribution with some degrees of freedom. It's very unlikely to have that. What they did was they did the SOWH test, and they did the Shimadara-Hasegawa test, which depends a little bit on the number of trees that are in view at the time. Now, under the parametric bootstrap, we get a p-value less than 0.01. Under the non-parametric bootstrap, we get a p-value up to about 0.99. Now, you don't need to know much statistics to know that's trouble. And that there's something wrong here. And now, I mean, the molecular biologist's attitude is fix it. Well, we're working on it, and one of my graduate students, Xiaofei Shi, who's here, is making some progress towards coming up with a good procedure to fix this. It's a hard problem. And I think what's interesting is we don't often see this sort of variation where you get something, you know, strong evidence to reject the null hypothesis here, no evidence to reject it here. And I mean, it's consistent. And it's not just with this data set. At least the group we work with, we've seen it with other data sets as well. And they're in a quandary, you know. Both of the procedures are built on reasonable procedures. The non-parametric, you might be a little happier with. The parametric, there's a dependence on the model, which you may be a little bit uncomfortable with, but clearly something has to be done, and so there are some robustness issues here. At least there's this. Well, let's look at the deviations from the model just that we can talk about, and I'll try to look at some of the effects. Now, I should say that I don't have a lot of answers here. We're working on them. I suspect these problems will keep me and some of my students going at least till I retire. There's lots of room for interesting work here. Certainly the molecular biologists have had a recognition their models are only an approximation, and there's quite a lot in their literature which worries about deviations from the model. What happens if this isn't true? And certainly dependence is certainly, we've assumed independence of sites. If you think about how a protein folds, it's clear that they're not independent. What happens at sites is going to depend on some of the neighboring sites, whether the sites are close in the sequence or close in the folded protein, because once the protein is folded, sites which may be neighbors, which are close. It's pretty hard to build a model of dependence where you've got 3,000 sites and it's not clear how to do that. Certainly an open question. The non-homogeneity across the model, the substitution process, and there's certainly empirical evidence that it is non-homogeneous across the tree, and people talk about the GC versus the AT content, just that's the proportion of GC sites versus the proportion of AT sites across the tree, and it's fairly well documented that you can get very different results depending on the if you've got heterogeneity there, you can get very misleading tree results. So it does, and there's certainly other types of non-homogeneity. This is a very simple one, and which does mess things up. There's a hypothesis, the covariant hypothesis, which suggests that evolution at a site may not be constant through time. The evolution rate at a site may not be constant through time. If a site becomes, through evolution, if it becomes very critical to the functioning of the protein, it may have a very slow rate of evolution because a change may, of course, be lethal, and the mutation would be lethal, and the organism would disappear. Other sites on the surface, on the soluble surface of a protein, many of those can change without really affecting the functioning of the protein. So there's certainly evidence of lateral gene transfer. Now, we've worked on a vertical descent model that the only changes occur through evolution. In bacteria, I mean, this is just where bacteria grab other people's DNA, other bacteria's DNA, and it's clearly the mechanism, or it's a very significant mechanism when bacteria develop immunity to antibiotics. They share DNA. So rather than having things happening nice and orderly as you vertically one site at a time, suddenly your little bacteria's grabbed another chunk of DNA and just managed to incorporate it into their genome. So this is certainly something, a deviation from the model. Again, it's something that happens in reality. We're working on it. It's a tough problem and trying to build a model. The rate matrix for the Markov process may be incorrectly specified. For amino acids, there are two standard rate matrices, JTT and PAM, and they are aggregated and in some sense don't model the details of the protein biology. Just let me indicate, if you look, there are four nucleotides and only 20 amino acids, so there's some redundancy in the amino acids. And to change, because there are only 20 amino acids instead of 64 that you might have, and so to get it, to change from one amino acid to another, sometimes you can only do it by changing two base pairs. Now, when we talk about instantaneous rate matrices, that's not always been taken into account well in these two models. So there are some problems just with these rate matrices. Now, so let me just think about the tools we've got to handle this sort of thing. I mean, in robustness, if you're a robustnik, the first thing you do is say, let's look at the influence function. The influence function is just sort of the change, if you change a data point, what is the change in the thing you're estimating, appropriately standardized. It's the idea is a derivative. I mean, you're looking at a change. The difficulty we run into here is that our outcome is at least the outcome we're interested in. We have a bunch of nuisance parameters which we have to estimate, and they're all sitting nicely in Euclidean space, and so they behave well. The tree structure is hard to think about. How do you measure the distance from one tree to the next tree? If I change some data and the tree changes, how do I measure structure? There are probably clever ways to do it. One can, with some thought, probably define an appropriate distance between trees, and some people have done that, but it does require some thought. It's not routine. The standard, if you pick up any standard robustness paper technique, they're not going to handle. in robustness and in most asymptotics, the idea of a Fréchet differentiability is a key idea that's giving you the appropriate smoothness, and if you can get that, you've got the asymptotic normality lying underneath things. It doesn't seem clear how to do that, and our asymptotics for the chi-squared are unlikely to work because we're both from discreteness and because a lot of the estimates sit on boundaries, and if you remember your asymptotic theory, we prove things by assuming things don't lie on boundaries, they're always in the interior of the appropriate set. So they may or may, chi-squared approximation may or may not be valid. It's certainly not clear that it is, and without some fairly good deep thought, one has, you know, and some work of some very bright graduate student, we may know some answers sometime. Let's just think about data outliers in this context. It's probably the most natural way to think of this is in terms of individual site likelihoods. We've got 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 individual site likelihoods. We want to see, we could define the outliers in terms of that. And what tends to happen, and I'll show you some data in just a minute, the sites with the extreme long log likelihoods tend to appear near gaps in the sequence, which suggests that there's maybe a misalignment going on locally and is leading to large log likelihoods. So sites with extreme log likelihoods tend to have large variances as we move across the tree. So you've got more noise in these sites. Now, interestingly, I'm learning the molecular biologists come up with robust methods before the statisticians get involved because they have to develop things. We're actually just starting to look. If you think about what you're doing in maximum likelihood, we're summing the log likelihoods. We're just taking the sum of the log likelihoods. Now, if you think in regression, what you're doing is you're summing the squared residuals. An obvious thing to do, and what Peter Ruseo did for regression, was simply replace that criteria by taking the median of the squared residuals, at least median of squares. Well, why don't we just, instead of maximizing the sum of the likelihoods, let's maximize the median of the likelihoods. It's going to give us some protection, possibly, against the, it'll give us protection against the outliers. It'll certainly limit them. The big issue with least median squares is you go up a level of complexity in computation, going from least squares to least median of squares, because it's a computationally complex problem. That's not an issue here. We're already in a horrible computational mess. So working with the medians as opposed to the sums isn't going to make any difference. I mean, the key is how you move through tree space, and it doesn't really matter what criteria you use. You just need to know whether you're better or worse where you are and how you might move to the next tree. So we don't pay any price in terms of the complexity. So I think we'll look at this. And actually, I'll probably lay claim at least for a few months to this problem anyway. We'll work at that in Dalhousie and try to get something out. I mean, clearly you can do other things. You can, instead of going all the way to the median, you can trim, you can take, at least trim squares as they do in regression. So let me just show you, this is just a data set. You can see these are the weighted log likelihoods. These are the gaps in the alignment. This was just given to me by one of Christian Blouin. And you can see you're getting the largest log likelihood contributions down near the gap. So there is some structure we can probably use to help identify outliers and pay some attention. And it may also be a diagnostic for just helping us with the, sorting out where gaps are. Now, this is an idea I wish I'd had. Andrew Roger, who I'm working with, had it before I started working with him, and they published it. if you think about robustness, what you'd like to do is find out the parts of the sequence where the phylogenetic signal is different from that in the remainder of the data. Now, that's important. If within a gene, that'll give you, might give you some indication of gene conversion or recombination going on within the gene, that there's, you know, the evolution of part of this is different than the evolution of the gene as a whole. If you start looking across genome and you start looking at genes, it'll tell you the extent to which all the genes are carrying the same phylogenetic signal or which they're not. So Andrew, John Archibald, who was his PhD student, and Andrew came up with the idea of a sliding likelihood window. I mean, very natural thing. You look at part of the data. You compute the data within the likelihood within a window. They chose 100 base pairs. And you compare it with the likelihood of the maximum. You've got a maximum likelihood tree based on your whole data. You compute the likelihood of the tree based on the data within the window, and you just see, are they, is there some evidence of a difference? And very, very natural idea of a window. They use, quite appropriately, used a parametric bootstrap to set the significance levels for change in the likelihood ratio. And with their work, this won't be terribly visible. This was from their paper, again a set of taxa. They looked at it, the tree based on all 787 positions here. Tree 2 is based on these 220, where it looks like the part deviating above the line is indicating the difference in the log likelihood, which is significant. And you see that you get a fairly different tree. This taxa has moved up here. These two taxa have interchanged. So you're getting different evolutionary messages out of different parts of the data. That's important to know. You then, as in robust, you have to say, well, why is that happening? You have to try to understand what is the molecular, what's going on at the molecular level, which is leading, was there an insertion here? Was there a deletion, recombination? What sort of thing was going on? So it helps you isolate where the interesting biochemistry is going on. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is.
I think the only difference is you're just sliding your window along, so you're not leaving them out at random as you might in a jackknife. You know, it's certainly not it's an idea that many of us would have. I mean, when you do smoothing, you know, you smooth within a window and slide the window along, so it's very much of that sort of flavor, and it's certainly a natural thing to do. Just a couple more here. This is just to talk about the amino acids and the nucleotides. I think I've said some of this. Of the 64 triples, there are only 20 amino acids. And I think at least the group we're working with is tending to be more interested in working with amino acids rather than the nucleotides, simply because they're the building blocks for the proteins. And there is some evidence that the use of the redundant codon, that's because in the triples you've got some codons which can change without changing the amino acid. That's what we mean by a redundant codon, often the third position, may vary across the tree, giving a misleading DNA tree. And this is just some recent work. I was, Yuji Yanaki has done at Dalhousie, one of the postdocs. And I'll just show you the result. He was interested in some dinoflagellates and was looking at the phylogeny. And if you did it on the DNA, just the four-letter alphabet, you got, there are two types, I I've had this explained to me, but it went over my head and out my head very quickly, I'm afraid. There's some biochemical or differences between these two types of dinoflagellates. On the ML tree, they branch together. If you look at the amino acids, you get a very different bit of information. Now, that's important. I mean, the scientific conclusions you draw from this, telling you what's going on in evolution, are very different than the scientific conclusions you draw from this. So we better make sure we at least be aware of that and make sure that it can make a, the way in which we analyze the model we use can make a difference as to the science we actually end up with. Now, I'll just finish up with one more. I'll talk about just with the independence, just to say what's going on. There are a couple of approaches. One is I've indicated you let rates of each site be a random effect. And one of the things you could do, and I think Ed Susco and Christian Blouin have had some success with this, is you look at some covariance determined by the protein structure, and you let the rate, you sort of start off with a base rate, and then you let it vary according to a regression style structure, according to some covariates, and certainly that seemed to make a difference. Some very recent work which they're doing, unfortunately I went away on sabbatical, and this whole group keeps moving ahead, so I'm now in a catch-up phase of trying to get back into some of the things they're doing. They're allowing the transition matrix to depend on the physical properties of the site, such as energy, and this again seems to be giving some very preliminary, some interesting results, at least from a preliminary analysis. So I think what I'll do is stop there. What I'd like to say is the problems are hard, at least they're hard to me. We need good ideas, good solutions. They're challenging. People care about the solutions you get. I mean, they will use them, just to echo Rob's comments, they'll use them as long as you code it up and put it on the molecular biology website so that the people can grab them. The packages they use are the ones that are on probably Joe Felsenstein's website, I think. And great, thank you.